Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 179. It's Monday, September 5th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, I've been wondering and meditating upon the issue of risk communication and risk assessment for a long time, and COVID-19 has certainly been a cause for that, since people seem to look at things very differently. And this week I was reminded of an interesting thought experiment that I heard many years ago that I thought was a good illustration of how our brain works and what we're trying to assess risk. So here is the thought experiment. You need to get someplace, and there's two passes that you must go through to get there. In the first pass, there are mosquitoes, and you have a 100% chance of being bit. And then when a mosquito bites you, you have a 5% chance of dying. In the second pass, you only have a 5% chance of getting bit by a mosquito. But if you get bit by that mosquito, there's a 100% chance of dying. Now, of course, if you, those who are not math impaired, will realize that this is equivalent. This is a 5% chance of dying going through either pass one or pass number two. So there's no difference in the risk of going one or the other, but our brains process these very differently. And in case you haven't figured it out, interestingly, people do not want to go through the second pass. The idea of certain death at a 5% chance scares people a lot more than, you know, getting bit by a mosquito, but then only having a 5% chance. Somehow, our minds obviously try to protect us from threats psychologically. So the whole idea of having a 95% chance to dodge the death seems more important in our mind than the 95% chance to dodge a mosquito bite. Even though they're equivalent, that's the way it works. And I think this gets at one of the things that we have. Like, for instance, okay, so we have about 500 COVID deaths a day in the U.S., which is a lot. That's getting up around that third, fourth, fifth cause of death region in the United States. So that's a very significant cause of death. Now, if we had some, say, new disease, which of course is also a little scary because we have more uncertainty about it, but say that 300 people were dying a day, I'm sorry, 500, about 500 people were dying a day, or about 3,000 or so, say, were dying a week. And whatever it was when you caught this disease, there was a nearly fatal all the time. My guess is people would be doing a lot more to avoid that than what we're dealing with now, is going through the proverbial mosquito where you have a really high chance of getting bit, in this case for SARS-CoV-2, getting that infection in this example, this thought experiment. But we really discount that a lot because we figure we can avoid the worst outcomes. You know, this is something that's really pronounced in adolescence, this sense of invulnerability and this kind of risk discounting, but it's present throughout our lives, and it's basically just part of the way the human brain works. And another way that this affects our lives and the way that we process problems and solutions is, you may have heard that a lot of times people say that You know, we do what's most urgent, but not necessarily most important. We tend to do those things that are right in front of us that seem very urgent, but may, in the medium and long term, not actually be the most important. That's just part of how our brains work. But this bias in the way our brains work also leads us to miscalculate and underestimate a lot of deaths or health risks. And in fact, that is exactly the set of health risks that we have in the modern world, is a whole bunch of things that are of moderate ability to kill you, and that you have to take a wide variety of interventions in order to prevent, for those that are preventable. But in a modern society, about half of those or so are actually preventable deaths, that we know things that we could do that that could prevent those deaths. So that's my meditation for the day. Okay, well, let's do the local COVID-19 update for Lucas County. There's still plenty of COVID rolling about locally and nationally. Lucas County average daily number of cases inched up just a little bit to 122 average per day reported. Of course, that's a huge underreporting. That's up from 119 the week before. We've actually seen a nice little steady increase in reported cases over the last 5 weeks or so. Testing positivity rates are still very high at 17% locally, 18% nationally, and a little lower, 14% in the U.S. Of course, the cases and the positivity rates are getting less and less meaningful, but the bottom line is there's plenty of COVID out there. Nursing home, long-term care facilities, a number of active cases, which is one of the few places where we do surveillance anymore. We had a slight drop. We've been running around 65 or 70 for the last 5 weeks or so, and we dropped from 70 to 65 in the last week, reported cases. Active cases reported in long-term care facilities. That's 31 residents and 34 staff. Fortunately, no more additional deaths reported in long-term care facilities. So with hospitalizations and ICU patients in the U.S., they are edging down. We're now down to about 31,000 people with COVID in the hospital and about 5,000 new people added each day. In Ohio and Lucas County, this seems to be edging down as well, but somewhat more slowly. Deaths, unfortunately, nationally are still sticking. This whole summer, we've been running in the 400s, and we're today just under 500 per day on average. So it's still killing plenty of people. Be careful out there, people. And by that, I generally mean wear a mask in crowded indoor public spaces. Okay, well, not much COVID news. I just have one, and this one actually is from China. This is from CNBC. Chengdu locks down 21 million people as Chinese cities battle COVID-19. One of China's biggest cities, Chengdu, announced a lockdown of its 21 million residents as it launched 4 days of citywide COVID-19 testing as some of the country's most populous and economically important urban centers battle outbreaks. Chengdu, which reported 157 domestically transmitted infections last Wednesday, is the largest Chinese city to be locked down since Shanghai in April and May. It remained unclear whether the lockdown would be lifted after the mass testing ended on Sunday. So, wow, 157 infections in a day. You know, we're practically averaging that in Lucas County if identified, and we're not even doing a good job of testing. Unlike the Chinese. So this is just basically just to highlight the fact that obviously two different worlds between pretty much China and the rest of the world, but definitely the China and the United States. China, of course, has its dynamic COVID zero policy, and they're really trying to crank it down to as close to zero as they possibly can. Okay, with that story continuing, other major cities, including Shenzhen in the south and Dalian in the northeast, have also stepped up COVID restrictions this week, ranging from work-from-home requirement to the closure of entertainment businesses in some districts. The move curtails the activities of tens of millions of people, intensifying the challenges for China to minimize the economic impact of a dynamic zero COVID policy that has kept China's borders mostly shut to international visitors and make it an outlier as other countries try to live with the coronavirus. Mainland China has reported no COVID death since May, leaving the national death toll at 5,000 226. Well, Ohio has way more than that. So no COVID deaths since May. We're averaging 500 a day. Well, there's a contrast for you. Of course, they're dealing with rolling lockdowns on large cities with millions and millions of people. Okay, well, the next couple stories deal with what's often an underappreciated basic of health, and that is water, specifically clean water. First up, Jackson, Mississippi to go without reliable drinking water indefinitely. This from Reuters. Jackson, Mississippi will go without reliable drinking water indefinitely, officials said last Monday, after pumps at the main water treatment plant failed, leading to the emergency distribution of bottled water and tanker trucks for 180,000 people. Jackson, the state capital, is more than 80% black or African American. The town has been under a boiled water alert for a month already. Until it is fixed, it means we do not have reliable running water at scale. It means the city cannot produce enough water to fight fires, to reliably flush toilets, and meet other critical needs. Yikes. That's like third world category. And speaking of the third world, this from Medical Express. Half of world's health facilities lack basic hygiene, says United Nations. Half of the world's healthcare facilities lack basic hygiene services, putting nearly 4 billion people at risk of greater infection, the United Nations said. These facilities do not have water and soap or alcohol-based hand rub where patients receive care and in their toilets, according to the World Health Organization and the UNICEF Children's Agency. Around 3.85 billion people use these facilities, putting them at greater risk of infection, including 688 million people who receive care at facilities with no hygiene services at all. If healthcare providers don't have access to hygiene service, patients don't have a healthcare facility, said UNICEF's Kellyanne Naylor. Hospitals and clinics without safe water and basic hygiene and sanitation services are a potential death trap for pregnant mothers, newborns, and children. Every year, around 670,000 newborns lose their lives to sepsis. This is a travesty, even more so as their deaths are preventable. Yikes. Well, folks, water is life, and clean water even more so. Okay, well, next up, going to do a little update here on the monkeypox outbreak happening worldwide here in the United States. This from Stat News. Study raises concerns about the effectiveness of the monkeypox vaccine. A new study is raising concerns about the effectiveness of the monkeypox vaccine being used in the United States and other parts of the world. The work, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, found that two doses of the vaccine induced relatively low levels of neutralizing antibodies against the monkeypox virus, and those antibodies had poor neutralizing capacity. The researchers note the so-called correlates of protection, what is needed in terms of immune system weaponry to be protected against monkeypox, are not known. Still, the evidence of low levels of neutralizing antibodies raises questions about how much protection is generated by two doses of the vaccine marketed by Jynneos in the U.S. and made by the Danish manufacturer Bavarian Nordic. There's only one monkeypox provider in the entire world. At this moment, it is unclear that what the relatively low monkeypox virus neutralizing titers mean for protection against disease and transmissibility, the researchers from Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, wrote. But one of the senior authors of the paper said what is clear is that people being administered this vaccine ought to be cautious about assuming they are protected against infection. The expectation is not that this will provide sterilizing immunity, said Marianne Koopmans, who heads Erasmus's Department of Viral Science, referring to the type of immunity that will block all infection. Koopmans adding that controlling the outbreak will require a suite of transmission-reducing tools, including isolation of cases, tracing and quarantining of contacts, and vaccination of people who have been exposed to the virus or at high risk of exposure. And I'd just like to stop and make a little editorial comment there. Of course, it would be great to have a vaccine that stops everything in its tracks forever. But that's a little bit unusual. There's a few vaccines that offer sterilizing immunity, which means it prevents infection and produces no disease whatsoever. But as in the case of most public health problems, you need a layered approach, what they are calling here a suite of transmission reducing tools, including isolation of cases, tracing and quarantine of contacts, and vaccination. So, vaccination can be a very, very important tool, but it's rarely the only thing you do to prevent a particular disease. The Erasmus study suggests, among other things, that a one-dose regimen seems to be inadequate to induce protection. The second vaccination is important for reaching detectable antibody levels, as individuals in a single-shot regimen hardly developed antibody responses 4 to 8 weeks after vaccination. The study also casts a shadow over the recent decision by the U.S. government and others to stretch vaccine supplies by giving people 1/5 of a regular dose and to do that by intradermal, that is, under the skin, rather than subcutaneous. Intradermal into the skin, rather than subcutaneous under-the-skin injection. Intradermal administration, which requires smaller doses to be protective, has been shown to be as effective as in other disease outbreaks with other types of vaccines. Should public health authorities rethink giving fractional doses of the monkeypox vaccine? Michael Osterholm, director of the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, thinks so. Osterholm thought the move to fractional dosing was made too quickly, based on too little data. I realize in a public health crisis, sometimes you have to make decisions with imperfect information, he said after reading the Erasmus study. But this is the kind of data that I think everyone needs to take a step back now and say, what does this mean for what we're doing right now? They don't have a lot of other tools, he acknowledged, but at the same time, if the tool you're using isn't adequate to do the job, then you have to consider that. Do we need to go back to full dose? Osterholm and others expressed concern that people getting the vaccine will conclude they have a level of protection that they may not have. So this may be a major setback. Although, in those layers of protections, it looks like in the U.S., where most of it has been transmitted by men who have sex with men, those men who have sex with men have changed their behavior a lot and reduced the epidemic a lot in the U.S. So that actually may be the driving factor more than the vaccine, in fact. So it's not just one thing, as is the case in many things in life. Okay, well, let's go big and talk about American life expectancy. Unfortunately, bad news. This from the New York Times. U.S. life expectancy falls again in historic setback. The average life expectancy of Americans fell precipitously in 2020 and 2021, the sharpest two-year decline in nearly 100 years, and a stark reminder of the toll exacted on the nation by the continuing coronavirus pandemic. In 2021, the average American could expect to live until the age of 76, federal health researchers reported last Wednesday. The figure represents a loss of almost 3 years in life expectancy since 2019, when Americans could expect to live on average nearly 79 years. The reduction has been particularly steep among Native Americans and Alaska Natives, the National Center for Health Statistics reported. Average life expectancy in those groups was shortened by 4 years in 2020 alone. The cumulative decline since the pandemic started, more than 6.5 years on average, has brought life expectancy to 65 among Native Americans and Alaskan Natives, on par with the figure for all Americans in 1944. In 2021, the shortening of lifespan was more pronounced among white Americans than among black Americans, who saw greater reductions in the first year of the pandemic. While the pandemic has driven most of the decline in life expectancy, a rise in accidental deaths and drug overdoses also contributed, as did deaths from heart disease, chronic liver disease, and cirrhosis, the new report found. And I'll add a little nuance there. With heart disease, there are actually a fewer number of deaths, but because those deaths by heart disease that are happening more often in younger people, it's driving a lower life expectancy. Obviously, if you die earlier, it affects a single death, causes life expectancy to go down a lot more than a few deaths. That's just a few years short of what the normal life expectancy would be. Until now, experts have been accustomed to measuring life expectancy changes in increments of months, not years. Even small declines of life expectancy of a tenth or two-tenths of a year mean that on a population level, a lot more people are dying prematurely than they really should be, said Robert Anderson, chief of mortality statistics at the National Center for Health Statistics. This signals a huge impact on the population in terms of increased mortality, he added. Dr. Stephen Wolf, director emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, characterized the diminution of life expectancy in the United States as historic. While other high-income countries were also hit hard in 2020, the first year of the pandemic, most had begun to recover by last year, he said. None of them experienced a continuing fall in life expectancy like the U.S. did. and a good number of them saw life expectancy start inching back to normal, Dr. Wolf said. Those countries had more successful vaccination campaigns and populations that were more willing to take behavioral measures to prevent infections, such as wearing masks, he added, saying the U.S. is clearly an outlier. But the coronavirus was not solely to blame. Long-standing health problems rooted in poverty, discrimination, and poor access to health care left Native Americans and Alaska Natives particularly vulnerable to the virus, said Dr. Ann Bullock, former director of diabetes treatment and prevention at the Federal Indian Health Service and a member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. 1 in 7 Native American and Alaska Natives has diabetes, the highest rate among racial ethnic groups in the United States, and many struggle with obesity or excess weight. Both conditions make people more susceptible to severe COVID-19, and crowded multi-generational housing adds to the risk as well. There's no doubt COVID was a contributor to the increase in mortality during the last couple years, but it didn't start these problems. It made everything that much worse, Dr. Bullock said. Average life expectancy in these populations is now lower than that of every country in the Americas except Haiti, which is astounding, said Noreen Goldman, professor of demography and public affairs at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. The continued plunge was all the more upsetting because it occurred after a successful vaccination campaign, she said, adding the Native American population did quite well in the vaccination efforts, and that made us feel that 2021 would not be as devastating as 2020. Asian Americans held the highest life expectancy among racial and ethnic groups, included in the new analysis, 83.5 years on average. The figure fell only slightly last year from 83.6 in 2020. It was the largest reduction in life expectancy in the United States over the course of a two-year period since the early 1920s, when life expectancy fell to 57.2 in 1923. That drop-off may have been related to high unemployment and suicide rates during an earlier recession, as well as a steep increase in mortality among non-white men and women. Although the U.S. healthcare system is among the best in the world, Americans suffer from what experts have called the U.S. health disadvantage, an amalgam of influences that erode well-being, Dr. Wolf said. These include a fragmented, profit-driven healthcare system, poor diet and a lack of physical activity, and pervasive risk factors such as smoking, widespread access to guns, poverty, and pollution. The problems are compounded for marginalized groups by racism and segregation, he added. The result is a high disease burden among Americans and shorter life expectancy compared with that in comparable high-income nations over the last two decades. Over 1 million Americans have died of COVID-19, and more died in 2021 than in 2020, despite the availability of vaccines. To date, only 2/3 of Americans are fully vaccinated, and only 1/3 have had a booster shot. The white population did worse in 2021 than communities of color, besides Native American and Alaska Natives, Dr. Wolf said. I think that's very telling. It reflects the greater efforts by Black and Hispanics to get vaccinated, to wear masks, and take other measures to protect themselves, and the greater tendency in white populations to push back on those behaviors. The longevity gap between men and women also grew by a couple of months in 2021. American women can now expect to live to 79.1 years, almost 6 years longer than men, whose life expectancy was 73.2 last year, according to the new data. The longevity gap between the sexes has been increasing for more than a decade, after narrowing between 2000 and 2010 to about 5 years. Okay, well, here's one take from a former New York City health commissioner. This from the New York Times. Life expectancy is falling. Here's how to change that. Life expectancy in the United States continued to decline in 2021, according to data released by the federal government. Is there a more fundamental barometer of the health of our nation? The stagnation of life expectancy reflects deep societal challenges, not just in our health system, but also in our economic and political systems. Although life expectancy is not a literal estimate of how long a newborn is expected to live, instead it reflects mortality trends for adults in a given year. It does represent the world our children are inheriting. The connection becomes visceral when you think of the children we have lost to gun violence from Uvalde, Texas, to Highland Park, Illinois, or the projected increase in pregnancy-related deaths and child poverty because of Roe v. Wade being overturned. The decrease in life expectancy, as I see it, is a composite of multiple phenomena. Life expectancy in the United States has lagged that of peer countries since 1980, driven in part by higher mortality rates among Black and American Indian adults and people of lower socioeconomic status. A recent analysis estimated that there were about 16 million American birthdays lost. That is years of life lost prematurely in 2019, based on a comparison of U.S. death rates with those in other wealthy countries. Even as COVID-19 was the major reason for the decline from 2019 to 2021, that broad characterization masked the contributions of misinformation and political polarization to prevent mortality since 2021, when COVID-19 vaccines became widely available. The pandemic's reverberating effects also extended to increases in overdose deaths, deaths related to pregnancy and childbirth, and deaths from chronic diseases such as diabetes, through pathways that are still being understood. In my own clinical practice, I've seen the grief, stress, and trauma of the past few years show up as spikes in blood pressure and blood sugar, or as foregone care. Although some of the backdrop mortality trends are called deaths of despair, collectively, this is not a time for nihilism or despondency. The decline in life expectancy is not inevitable. We need only to look to peer countries like Spain and Canada, where modeling based on preliminary data suggests a life expectancy rebound in 2021 despite COVID-19, in part because of widespread vaccination. America is at a fork in the road with respect to the health of the nation. One path would parallel what happened after the 1918 flu, known as both the Great Influenza and the Forgotten Pandemic. Although life expectancy increased as the number of flu deaths subsided, its trajectory remained similar to that before the pandemic. The stories of the millions of lives lost perhaps took a backseat to narratives of nationalism and victorious valor in World War I. We are at risk of a similar collective amnesia after COVID-19. Another path, however, would parallel the response to the unyielding outbreaks of typhus, smallpox, dysentery, and cholera in the 19th century. A great sanitary awakening didn't just save lives. It changed the way society thought about protecting health as a public responsibility. Disease control at the time included cleaning up and improving the common environment, with a particular focus on impoverished areas and children's health. In New York City, cholera deaths among the poor helped lead to the Metropolitan Health Law, which regulated sanitary conditions and laid the groundwork for modern health departments. What would a modern Metropolitan Health Law look like on a national scale? Even as it would address different conditions and proximate causes of illness, a focus on low-income people and marginalized communities would remain consistent. Looking at average changes in life expectancy obscures the fact that before the pandemic, increasing mortality was concentrated among lower-income groups. More recent data from California during the pandemic suggests that the gap in survival by income may have widened further, particularly among Hispanic and Black people. Given that health is tightly linked to economic security, economic policy must be viewed as health policy. Policy solutions that affect educational opportunities, housing prospects, and social mobility have particularly important implications for health. Direct financial and in-kind assistance for low-income families, such as through the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps, and further expansion of the earned income tax credit, are evidence-based and effective. Lessons from the COVID-19 response should also lead to investment in the National Public Health Corps, a cadre of community health workers both serving and drawn from the most marginalized neighborhoods across the country, providing a health workforce, economic resources, and jobs in one fell swoop. Broader preparedness for the next infectious disease threat must appropriately resource local and state public health agencies, from laboratory capacity to misinformation response. The country should also derive inspiration from our 19th century forebears in focusing on the suffering of children. Firearm-related injuries have become the leading cause of death among children, a shocking reality. Climate change threatens infants and other children through extreme heat, food insecurity, insect-borne diseases, and more. Beyond advocacy, public health has a particular role in scaling up services to address these and other adverse childhood experiences, for instance through new family home visiting programs. An economic policy such as making the child tax credit permanent, providing baby bonds to address wealth inequality, and investment in early childhood education have potential for major health dividends. Polarization, partisanship, and lack of trust, both in government and interpersonally, can cost lives. Overcoming this will require an embrace of new narratives. For instance, the scholar Heather McGee describes the zero-sum thinking associated with structural racism, the trope that for some to advance, others must regress. The zero-sum story has eroded our willingness to resource public goods for all of us, from education to transportation. Here, too, a focus on children can help. Is there a more powerful identity than that of a parent, grandparent, or caregiver? What if the stories we told were rooted in those identities and our policies were measured against the health benefits that our children could expect? It would start by reframing each of the policies described above by leading with their effects on children. If I could write a sweeping prescription, it would be for millions of parents who have not voted in state or national election in the last 5 years, organizing to get them to the polls and giving them a reason to vote on the social and economic policies that shape health may be the key to reversing the decline in life expectancy in the United States. I care about that as a doctor, but even more so as a father. And I will note that I'm glad to report, I guess, that at least Republicans have stopped talking about family values, and hasn't been a lot. I suppose maybe Trump kind of destroyed that. It'd be nice if they actually had family values, but at least we don't have the hypocrisy of talking about it when in fact their public policy initiatives, if any, match up with that. You are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. This is Just for the Health of It in the School of, in the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Next up, we're switching to another major preventable cause of death and decreased life expectancy in the United States. That is diet and nutrition. This from NPR. The U.S. diet is deadly. Here are 7 ideas to get Americans eating healthier. The data are stark. The typical American diet is shortening the lives of many Americans. Diet-related deaths outrank deaths from smoking, and about half of the U.S. deaths from heart disease, nearly 900 deaths a day, are linked to poor diet. The pandemic highlighted the problem, with much worse outcomes for people with obesity and other diet-related diseases. We're really in a nutrition crisis in this country, says Darish Mozafarian, a cardiologist and dean of the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. Now there's growing momentum to tackle this problem. The Biden administration will hold the White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health on September 28th and will announce a new national strategy. This comes more than 50 years after a landmark White House conference, which helped launch today's major federal food assistance programs. The 1969 conference was transformative, Mozafarian says. The programs it ushered in, like the WIC program, have helped feed millions of low-income families. But this hasn't been enough to solve the dual problems of food insecurity and diet-related disease. Food policy leaders say it's time to think anew and build on what we've learned. The U.S. can't fix hunger by just feeding people cheap, high-calorie processed food, the food that's so abundant in our food supply, they say. Instead, it's got to find ways to nourish people with healthy, nutrient-dense foods. There's a lot of enthusiasm in thinking about food more broadly and how we can fix this crisis, Mozafarian told NPR. He's co-chair of an independent task force that includes doctors, chefs, food policy and business experts, as well as farming and health advocates, who are helping form the agenda at the upcoming White House conference. In a new report, they proposed a wide-ranging set of recommendations to end hunger, advance nutrition, and improve health. Here are 7 big ideas they're excited about. Nutrition advocates say SNAP and WIC benefits, which give low-income families money for groceries, could be designed to incentivize buying more fresh produce. Up first, number 1, treat food as medicine. There's a growing movement to integrate food and nutrition into healthcare by providing healthy meals and groceries to patients to help prevent or manage diet-related illness. The task force wants to see this kind of work expand. We should pay for food-based interventions that are effective. For example, there's mounting evidence that providing prescriptions for fruit and vegetables can spur people to eat better and manage weight and blood sugar. The idea is for healthcare systems or insurers to provide or pay for healthy groceries combined with nutrition education to help patients change their eating habits. It's being piloted around the country. Produce prescription programs help improve diet quality and food security, says task force member Dr. Hillary Seligman, a food insecurity expert and professor of medicine at University of California, San Francisco, noting that they can help with diet-related diseases like high blood pressure and diabetes. Another idea is to offer medically tailored meals aimed at helping people who are already sick reverse chronic disease. Currently, the federal government is running pilot programs that let Medicaid or Medicare pay for the meals in several states. Idea number 2, focus on quality of calories, not just quantity. The U.S. food supply is awash in cheap calories, and when you're on a tight budget or relying on benefits like SNAP, food stamps, processed foods like chips and soda can set you back less than fresh produce, Of course, eating processed foods also contributes to cardiovascular disease, stroke, diabetes, and other chronic illnesses, warns Nancy Brown, CEO of the American Heart Association. Brown says federal food assistance programs have helped to address hunger. However, many U.S. food policies and programs focus on improving access to sufficient quantities of food, she says. Instead, it's time to modernize these policies and focus on the quality of food so people have access to enough nutritious food. The task force wants to see food programs redesigned to nudge people towards healthier options. The report points to the GusNIP Nutrition Incentive Program, which in select communities gives SNAP participants more money to buy fruits and vegetables. It's a similar concept to the Double Bucks program, which doubles the value of SNAP benefits when used to buy produce at farmers markets and other venues. It is important to scale up these efforts to ensure that everyone has access to healthy food options, said task force member Angela Odoms Young, a nutrition professor at Cornell University. The task force recommends that Congress establish a nationwide produce incentive program for all SNAP participants. These types of programs can help promote equity, Odom Young says, noting that people of color disproportionately suffer from chronic illnesses. To nudge people to eat more fruits and vegetables, one idea is to expand access to programs that give SNAP beneficiaries more money when they buy produce at places like farmer markets. 3. Expand access to dietary and lifestyle counseling. The Affordable Care Act mandates that diet counseling be covered by insurers as a preventive care benefit for those at higher risk of chronic disease. The exact details of who is eligible for which services are left up to an advisory group of doctors and healthcare providers, as well as insurers, and many patients who would benefit may not have access to this service. The vast majority of Americans would be getting preventative behavioral lifestyle treatment, Mozafarian says. Too often, he says, doctors prescribe drugs for conditions before recommending or trying lifestyle changes. Doctors go right to the drugs, he says. I think that's a big problem. The task force recommends that Congress expand Medicare and Medicaid coverage for medical nutrition therapy to people with high blood pressure, prediabetes, celiac disease, HIV/AIDS, cancer, and other diet-related conditions. It also calls for expanded coverage of cooking classes and nutrition assistance, as well as coverage of the diabetes prevention program delivered by telehealth. This behavior change program has been shown to be more effective than medicine in reducing the onset of type 2 diabetes among people at high risk. Idea 4. Support food entrepreneurs. People who start food businesses can help nourish their communities and create jobs. The task force calls on the federal government to pass policies that boost new, healthy food enterprises, including providing new loans and grants to food and nutrition-related companies that are centered on health, equity, and sustainability. The idea is to focus especially on businesses owned by people of color and other marginalized groups. We don't need more businesses creating diabetes and obesity, says Tambra Ray Stevenson, who runs WANDA, a nonprofit group that aims to build a pipeline and platform for 1 million black women and girls to become local food leaders. We need entrepreneurs that provide teaching kitchens, community gardens, healthy food retails, wellness studios, nutrition services, healthy consumer products, and urban agricultural centers, she says. She points to food entrepreneurs like Amanda Stevenson, who opened a specialty food market in an underserved neighborhood in Washington, D.C., Fresh Food Factory, and Mary Blackford of Market 7, who is planning a food hall that features black-owned food and lifestyle businesses. They are our food sheroes, making a positive impact and providing healthy food access for our children and other women, says Stevenson. In the lead-up to next month's White House conference, groups like Food Think Tank, have organized listening sessions with food researchers and entrepreneurs. For food to be more accessible and affordable, we need entrepreneurs that use science and technology, says Daniel Nirenberg of the Food Tank. She points to innovators like Journey Foods, which is helping entrepreneurs bring nutritious foods and snacks to market. Idea 5. Increase the number of new farmers growing healthy foods using regenerative farming techniques. If all Americans begin to eat the recommended amounts of fruits and vegetables each day, there would be shortages. That's because corn and soybeans are grown on most cropland in the U.S. Now there's growing recognition of the need for more specialty crops, including fruits, vegetables, and nuts. The task force recommends that Congress create a farmer corps to support new farmers, building on the Beginning Farmers and Ranchers Development Program. The idea is to provide new farmers with paid internships and apprenticeships to learn about sustainable farming and funding to cover a living wage and housing. It also is pushing for loans to go to farmers growing with sustainable practices. Growing the same crop season after season, as many farmers do, can make lands less productive over time and deplete nutrients from the soil. The unfortunate reality is that today we subsidize conventional practices that degrade the soil, said David Montgomery, a professor at the University of Washington and author of What Your Food Ate, who attended a listening session. What we need to sustain agriculture is to incentivize restoring healthy soils and train more farmers to be successful doing that, he says. Idea 6, make school meals free for all students. We tried that during the pandemic. School meals have been a fixture of U.S. schools ever since President Harry Truman signed the National School Lunch Act back in 1946. For decades, the federal government has reimbursed schools for meals they serve, and low-income students can qualify for free or reduced-price meals. Research has shown that low-income children who participate have better health. Yet, many families who are eligible for free or reduced lunch meals may not receive them, sometimes due to the paperwork, bureaucracy, or stigma of participating or enrolling. Amid the pandemic, school meals have been offered to free for all students. Now, the task force says this should be made a permanent change. Without access to free meals at school, many children go without food at all during the day, and many more do not have access to the nutritious foods they need to thrive, said Selleming of UC San Francisco. She notes that school meals not only help with kids' nutrition, but they also reduce absenteeism and improve academic outcomes. Idea 7, establish a federal food czar. In order to turn ideas like this into action, the task force recommends the creation of a new role in the federal government, a national director of food and nutrition, a food czar figure, if you will. The new director would help streamline and coordinate the many disparate efforts already underway. The U.S. government spends more than $150 billion each year on food and nutrition-related programs, and the healthcare system also spends billions on treatment of diet-related diseases. This spending is fragmented across 200 separate actions and 21 different departments and agencies without harmonization or synergy, the task force concludes. Now they concluded it's time for a new approach. Yep, these are just some of the ideas where there's a lot of opportunity to improve nutrition and health of our nation. Okay, well, in honor of me recording this on Labor Day, I'd like to do something tying in the health of basically income security and overall health of individuals in a population. This from Medical Express. How can a welfare state boost population health? Welfare state decommodification is associated with a lower age standardized death rate and improved population health due to both direct and indirect mechanisms, according to a new study published in the Open Access Journal Plus One. Decommodification, the reduction in the scope and influence of the free market on citizens' lives, is an outcome of welfare states that provide strong social programs. Previous research has established a relationship between overall welfare state generosity and population health, but the exact mechanisms associating decommodification with health are poorly understood. In the new study, the researchers using data spanning from 1971 to 2010 on the age-standardized death rates per 100,000 inhabitants in 21 countries belonging to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. They found a negative correlation between the death rate and levels of decommodification. When they analyzed separate correlates of decommodification, they found that decreased labor market polarization, the ratio of jobs with lower and higher skill and pay, and decreased labor market risk, which describes the risk associated with unemployment, were associated with improved population health, particularly in men. However, income redistribution was not associated with health. The authors conclude that population health relates less to the direct redistribution of income and more to the reduced vulnerability to risk and social insecurity associated with the welfare state generosity. The authors add, the welfare state contributes to healthier lives directly by providing resources and services to individuals and indirectly by reducing labor market income polarization and risk. Of course, we've known for a long time that unemployment or underemployment is very dangerous for your health. So when, quote, welfare states help mitigate that, population health improves. Of course, healthcare for all is one right and service that would fall under the category of the so-called welfare state.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely, It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
You know, I try to stay away from a lot of the stories around the tinkering of the U.S. so-called healthcare system. But with the aptly named Inflation Reduction Act, there were definitely some healthcare things, and there was some good stuff in there, but it was definitely a hodgepodge. And most of the attention has been on the Medicare being able to control drug prices. But of course, that hasn't come for years down the line, and there's a limited number. So that's going to be years away. But there's some stuff that happens right away that actually most of the real savings are. And I want to do just a small section of this guest opinion from the Daily Camera. Letting Medicare negotiate drug prices won't be the game changer Democrats hope it will be. Where the real savings are. Importantly, the new law limits seniors' out-of-pocket expenses for prescription drugs to no more than $2,000 annually. Previously, there were some restrictions, but no limit. This will directly help 1.4 million seniors who exceeded the $2,000 threshold in 2020. The law also limits how fast premiums for Medicare Part D, which provides premium-based prescription drug insurance, can rise over the next few years and implements a number of other adjustments. It also extends the Medicare Part D low-income subsidy to 400,000 seniors who previously earned too much to qualify. This program helps people pay for premiums, deductible, and copays, and has been valued at $5,100 a year. The legislation also limits the cost of insulin to no more than $35 per month for Medicare recipients only. This amounts to more than $1 billion in annual savings for seniors. Almost 16 million Americans have diabetes and are likely to need insulin at some point in their lives. Lastly, it also eliminates out-of-pocket costs for seniors for vaccines, a move that would have saved money for 4.1 million people in 2020. It's interesting that under Obamacare, the ACA preventive services, including vaccines, have to be free, but under Medicare, that hasn't been the case up until now. But, of course, our healthcare system kicks our butts in many ways financially, so I wanted to do this little story from Kaiser Health News. This is actually a reference to their podcast, An Arm and a Leg, and is entitled How to Negotiate for Lower Medical Bills. Negotiating medical bills is often possible. It sounds hard, and it can be, but what if we got it down to a science? Mapped out all the moves ahead of time. Jared Walker and his team at the nonprofit $4 are running a big experiment to see whether they can do just that. The folks at $4, that's F-O-R-4, went super viral on TikTok in early 2021 with a 60-second recipe for crushing medical debt by accessing charity care, financial assistance that most U.S. hospitals are legally required to help. And there's actually a link to that in the article. I'll give that at the end of the show. Next, a group of whip-smart volunteers helped $4 develop a user-friendly system, also a link to that, to help people apply for that assistance. $4 also started holding lessons on Zoom, links to that as well, teaching people the ins and outs of applying for charity care and helping others to do so. The group says its work has helped erase more than $18 million in medical debt. But lots of people who can't afford their medical bills don't qualify for charity care, so $4 is trying something new, what they're calling a negotiation lab, for gaming out the best way to negotiate with hospitals and debt collectors. In the current episode, we listen in on $4's real-life negotiations with a debt collector. And you can get a link to this article and those three links that I reference in this story going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT, and I'll give that a link again at the end of the show. Okay, well, I want to switch gears now and do an abortion-related story. This from The Conversation. When abortion at a clinic is not available, 1 in 3 pregnant people say they will do something on their own to end the pregnancy. 1 in 3 people in need of abortion will consider doing something on their own to end the pregnancy if they are unable to get an abortion at a clinic. These are findings of a study I recently published after surveying over 700 people seeking abortions in 3 states across the U.S., Illinois, California, and New Mexico. The 1 in 3 figure is even higher among those who have a difficult time affording the cost of their abortion, have no health insurance, or are seeking an abortion because of concerns about their own physical or mental health. These findings offer a clear snapshot of what lies ahead as states move to ban abortion outright or severely restrict access. Research over the past 2 decades has shown that pregnant people who face obstacles to getting an abortion to an abortion clinic or who have a desire for a more natural or private abortion experience will try to end a pregnancy on their own. This might include turning to self-sourced abortion pills, alcohol or drugs, herbs, or physical methods. My own research in 2017 found that 7% of U.S. women of reproductive age will use one of these methods in their lifetime to try to end a pregnancy outside of the formal healthcare system. What has changed recently and dramatically is access to clinic-based abortion. When the Supreme Court decision overturning federal protections on abortion access, as of August 30th, 14 states have already implemented bans on abortion, an additional 12 are projected to do so in the coming months. These restricted abortion states are home to just over one half of U.S. women of reproductive age. Putting these numbers together with the data on those who seek abortion in the U.S., researchers estimate that over 100,000 pregnant people per year will soon face insurmountable travel distances to their nearest abortion provider, unable to get an abortion at their clinic. If people do as they project in our study, around 33,000 pregnant people per year will consider doing something on their own to end a pregnancy. One yet unanswered question is how many of those in need of abortion unable to get to a clinic will be able to end a pregnancy on their own with a safe and effective message, such as the FDA-approved medications mifepristone and mifepristol or mifepristol alone, versus how many will turn to other, likely less effective methods with potentially harmful outcomes. Researchers now have clear evidence that telehealth and mail order models enabling access to medication abortion without the need for an in-person visit with a healthcare provider, models accelerated in part by the COVID-19 pandemic, are safe, effective, and satisfactory to patients. However, these models remain out of reach for some. This is especially true for those who are further along in their pregnancy, cannot afford the cost, live in one of the 19 states that ban telehealth provisions of medication abortion, or don't have a safe place to receive and use the pills. What is also unknown is how many pregnant people will face legal repercussions for doing something to try to end a pregnancy. Although public support for criminalizing a pregnant person for self-managing an abortion is low, state legislators are actively proposing such policies. Between 2000 and 2020, more than 61 people were investigated or arrested for such attempts. In the coming months, my colleagues and I will document the magnitude of any increase in self-managed abortion by repeating a nationally representative survey that we fielded in 2017 and 2021. Our research underscores that even when abortion is restricted, people will move forward with abortion on their own. Having access to abortion pills is critical so that when people need to self-manage an abortion, the health, medical, and advocacy community is supporting them to do so safely and effectively. Hear, hear. Amen. Okay, well, I want to end the show with some good news that I missed out on last week's show, and this was from Associated Press. Gender dysphoria covered by disability law court rules. A federal ruling that gender dysphoria is covered by the American with Disabilities Act could help block conservative political efforts to restrict access to gender-affirming care, advocates and experts say. A panel of the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals became the first federal appellate court in the country to find that the 1990 landmark federal law protects transgender people who experience anguish and other symptoms as a result of the disparity between their assigned sex and their gender identity. The ruling could become a powerful tool to challenge legislation restricting access to medical care and other accommodations for transgender people, including employment and government benefits, advocates said. The ruling is binding in the states covered by the Richmond-based 4th Circuit, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia, but will inevitably be cited in cases in other states, said Kevin Berry, a law professor at Kennepec University. The modern diagnosis of gender dysphoria affirms that a transgender person's medical needs are just as deserving of treatment and protection as anyone else, Judge Diana Gribben-Motz wrote in the majority opinion. Okay, well, now time for our bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. All available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. I'll give you a link at the end of the list. Only 9 this week. That's kind of a low for a long time. First up, how the pandemic shortened life expectancy in indigenous communities. So a follow-up for a story I did this show. And another follow-up for reporting this show. Number 2, food is medicine intervention should be the main course at White House Nutrition Conference. That's like prescribing vegetables and such. 3, the tragedy of North Birmingham, where industrial pollution of air and land and its historic black communities for over a century, officials continue to fail to right the wrongs. So that's the bad news from ProPublica. Good news, bonus story 4, Texas-Mexico border town approves air pollution monitoring following ProPublica and Texas Tribune investigation. Investigative journalism works. 5, Rahul Gupta, first physician to serve as drug czar, says stigma among doctors is a key culprit in addiction crisis. Yes, physician views and attitudes on addiction are important. 6, the U.S. lacks adequate education around puberty and menstruation for young people. This is a little bit deeper dive into our poor sex education and just basic biology, but it's particularly important since young girls are going to need to know about puberty and menstruation with the new anti-abortion laws rampant across the country. 7, the heat wave crushing the West is a preview of farm workers' hot future. What will this mean for agriculture and farm worker communities? Clue? Not good. And 8, when migrant children in custody attempt to take their lives. These are this family separation thing when you've got young children in federal custody. There has been a spate of suicide attempts. And 9, major depression. The chemical imbalance pillar is crumbling. Is the genetics pillar next? Dun, 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 dun. And the spoiler alert is yes, it looks like it. You can access links to these stories and all the show stories during this episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-